What's up, family? Thank you for tuning into another episode of With the Facts podcast. I am Mariel, your creator and host. And so I'm really grateful that you are here. I say that every single week, but I really am thankful that you're tuned in, that you're listening. As many of us know, COVID has really completely reshaped our lives as a country and as a world. We're having to still social distance, and hopefully you're wearing your mask as you go out. But we've seen this great divide and where it's become incredibly politicized. And so I want to always make sure that this podcast is informing and educating. And so I really just wanted to talk to a medical professional to just kind of debunk some of the myths that we've heard around COVID-19, aka coronavirus. And so I had the great opportunity of sitting down and having a conversation with Dr. Tyson Bell. And he kind of walks us through what he's seen in patients, and just to give us a little bit more background about this virus and what it looks like. And so I really hope that you find this helpful. And please do me a favor. Make sure that you are taking good care of yourself, that you're using every precaution, you're making wise decisions. And of course, please wear your mask when you go out into public spaces. Make sure you are social distancing. And of course, make sure you are using proper hygiene. All right, without further ado, sit back, relax, and let's dive into today's episode. What's up, family? Thank you for tuning into another episode of With the Facts podcast with Mariel. I'm Mariel, and I'm grateful that you are here. Today, I am really excited to just have a really good conversation to debunk some of the myths that we have seen around COVID-19. This started around maybe late February, early March, and we are still in the middle of it. And so I thought, why not talk to a medical professional who knows what's going on and can give us some facts? So I am very excited to have Dr. Tyson Bell with me and on the podcast, and I'm ringing him in right now. There he is. Hey, Dr. Bell, how are you
doing? Hello. Nice. Thanks to have me on. Thank you.
Of course. Of course. So I guess let's just start with, give us a little bit about who you are, just a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I'm an infectious disease attending and critical care physician at the University of Virginia. I'm also a director of the medical ICU. I take care of COVID patients here and non-COVID patients that are critically ill. That's the majority of what I do, in addition to a variety of educational roles that I have at the School of Medicine and the hospital. So academic medical center, providing COVID care for people that are critically ill. So that's, that means that my life has been pretty busy the last few months, unfortunately.
Absolutely. So let's start with the basics. We've heard all kinds of things about what COVID-19 is, what the coronavirus is. Some people say it's the flu, or it's just like the flu, or it's a cold, or maybe it'll be a little bit worse than your allergies. So what can you actually give us some background on what really is the coronavirus?
What sure. Is that? Yeah. So the coronavirus is it's in the same family as a lot of the viruses that cause the common cold. The main difference is that we have never seen this virus before. And when there's a virus that's able to infect people that they have never seen before, and there's no immunity to it, meaning there's no protection that we've built up against it, then that's when you can see it can go through a large group of people and cause a lot of problems. It is spread similar to the way that the flu is spread, mainly through droplets, which come out of droplets that come out of your nose, your mouth, when you talk, breathe, sing, exhale. And then there's maybe, some thought that there could be some aerosols or really small particles that go into the air. But the main difference with the flu is that it's more deadly than the flu, about 10 times more deadly than influenza. And it's easier to spread than influenza. At most instances, at least twice as easy to spread. And that's why you've really seen this take over the globe and really disrupt, everything about our daily life, because it's causing infection in so many people. The mortality rate, or how likely you are to die, is still relatively low, but it's infecting so many people. That's why we're seeing so many people that are ultimately passing away and getting very sick, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And when this first started, I think the communication was, oh, it's really for older people. Like they are the more susceptible group, but it looks like that has quickly changed. And so what have you seen on your end? What is about the average age patient maybe that you've seen come in that's been diagnosed with COVID?
No, there really is no average patient because I've seen them all. Yeah. You know, the thing about the numbers is that, yes, if you are older in age, you are more likely to have a worse outcome just on a percentage basis. But if you're younger, you have a more likelihood of doing well with the virus. But when the virus is infecting so many younger people, then you end up seeing a lot of young people that are really sick with COVID-19. So in our ICUs, it runs the gamut. We're seeing some people that are young. And when I say young, I'm meaning 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And then, you know, people that are older as well, too. And, you know, the main difference is, you know, it takes a lot of different people to get infected. So for you to ultimately see folks coming to the ICU. So when we see young community and young people coming in, then we know that it's infecting so many people in in that community that we are seeing some of those cases. So I wouldn't say that there's an average person who comes to the ICU sick with COVID because it can literally look like anybody.
Yeah. So what are some symptoms that we should be looking out for? I know I have actually talked to some people who have recovered from COVID, mm-hmm. And it's been several of them, and the symptoms have kind of all looked different. So what are some standard symptoms that we should look for that we may need to suspect we might probably need to get tested?
Right. Well, the most common symptoms will be the symptoms that are similar to the flu. So that's fever, cough, and shortness of breath. And by far, those are the most likely combination of things that we will see. Not necessarily all three at the same time, but people that have those symptoms have been very common. In addition, I've heard a lot of people report headaches that they haven't had before. Even people who've had migraines say that this is a different sort of headache. You may have heard about the loss of the sense of taste or smell. That's a real thing. There have been several people who have said that this is not something that they normally experience, but they have. I have a colleague who the partnership got really sick and had their breathing symptoms. His wife really just lost her sense of smell for a couple of weeks. So it can really range from people, and of course it can include people that don't have symptoms or really mild symptoms, all the way to people who have more severe symptoms. But more commonly, it'll be a combination of fever, cough, shortness of breath with some of the other sort of symptoms like body aches and chills, headaches, loss of sense of smell.
Gotcha. So we have seen, unfortunately, this become incredibly politicized, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially with wearing a mask, not to wear a mask. Here in Georgia, our governor has sued our mayor because she wants to institute a mandate of all of us wearing masks when we're out in public spaces. So some people feel like, well, the mask is not going to do anything. And some people feel like, oh, the mask is definitely going to protect us. So kind of give us a medical opinion on that. Like, does the mask help to prevent the spread of this? Or is it just, you know, if you feel like it, wear it. If you don't, you should be fine.
Yeah. So it's important to talk a little bit about the history of how this has evolved, because the guidance initially was that mask use in the general population wasn't necessary. This was in the earlier days when we were still learning about the virus and we were still kind of comparing it to influenza. And also we had a crunch on PPE or personal protective equipment at that point. So it was felt at the time that the risk of having a lot of people buy surgical masks and not have it available to healthcare workers outweighed the potential benefit that wearing masks would have. Lo and behold, we have evidence after evidence coming out that wearing masks is beneficial, and the PPE crunch wasn't as pervasive. So we were able to expand that recommendation and recommend that the general public wear a mask. And we've seen that it does lower transmission. It works when a critical mass or a lot of people are wearing a mask. So if you're going into a restaurant or a store in an enclosed space where there's a higher risk and there's only a few people wearing a mask, it's not as safe for everyone, whether you're wearing a mask or not. Whereas you go into a space where there is a lot of mask use and most of the people have a mask on with, you know, some few exceptions, collectively, that's a much safer space to be in. So it works. It just, you have to have a lot of people who are on board with the message. And, you know, different things are going to work for different people. Some people will respond to, you know, the collective responsibility part. Some people will say, you know, if I want to, you know, keep my neighbor safe and keep myself safe, this is what I want to do. Or think about returning to schools, opening the economy. Mask use is a tool to do that. It's not they're not enemies, and that's kind of been politicized. And then for some people, a mandate sets the tone that, you know, this is serious enough that this is going to be a requirement if we come out. I think we can debate whether, you know, the punitive measures or mandates are necessary or not. But I think at the very least, setting the strong message that this is something that's so important that we're writing it into, you know, our guidance for what you should do in our laws. You know, really lets us know, you know, this is an important thing that we should take seriously. So I liken it to you stop at a stoplight and you wear a seatbelt and you obey the speed limit when you drive a car. You take your shoes off or you go through a metal detector when you go to the airport. Those are things that are a minor inconvenience. It slows us down, but we agree to all do it for the sake of the common good, so that everyone is safe, because we all go through the small sacrifice. It's just like that. The only problem here, of course, is that this is all happening so fast that we don't really have time to debate this. It really needs to be, you know, something that we do now to stop the spread now.
Absolutely. So one of the issues that we're still having in this country is testing. Mm-hmm. And so though now there are testing sites that are available, it usually takes about 2 weeks possibly to get your results. So walk us through what the testing is, and from a medical perspective, what needs to improve on the testing end for you to be able to possibly see more patients and get patients well?
Sure. So the testing, you know, testing has been a hard problem from the beginning in the United States. And, you know, we can go back and you know, talk about, you know, what the issues has been. But, you know, just to talk about what's going on right now, we have expanded our testing capacity. So we're doing around 700,000 tests per day. It's important to recognize that our recommendation at the very minimal is 500,000, but really it should be close to 1 million or more tests per day that we should be able to do. But the other concerning thing is that, particularly in our hotspots, and I'm thinking about Arizona, Florida, Texas, California, South Carolina, these are kind of the hottest of the hotspots that we have right now. There is some local testing constraints and inability to get testing results to people quickly. And I've also seen reports of long lines at testing sites. The thing about testing is that you want to be able to get the results quickly to the person who's taking a test so that they can act on that information. You know, what we advise people to do when they take their test is to quarantine yourself or isolate yourself until you get the results back. And if they're negative, and if we think that it's low likelihood that you had it, then we could say you can come off of that isolation and behave as normally. And obviously, if you're positive, you want to continue isolating for 2 weeks. Problem with waiting a full week to get that test result back is now the person who is taking that test has to think about the consequences of waiting a week or even longer to get those test results back. That makes you less likely to want to get the test, particularly if it's something that's required, you know, that might affect how you live at home or something like that. So we really need to shorten that time, because we don't want to just depend on people taking a test, waiting, you know, this whole length of time to get the test result back before they can act on it. We want to be able to get it quicker. So what that requires is going to be more investment in our testing infrastructure. This has largely been pushed to the states to implement at the guidance of the White House, or I should say non-guidance of the White House. But in order to really ramp this up, it needs to be a coordinated national effort so that we can make sure that we get supplies to places where that need them, and we can help shorten that timeline.
Yeah. So in reading a lot of things about the virus, the thing that many of us have noticed is that people of color seem to be more susceptible and have a higher fatality rate when it comes to the virus. Can you explain why that is and why people of color seem to be more susceptible to the virus?
Right. So I think we should just call out structural racism in healthcare in our society. And I point to that as a central reason why there are these health disparities. And you know, that's a word that, you know, of course, like those powerful words you use, it elicits a lot of feelings, but I think it's important just to call it out. So the medical reason that people of color, you know, more or less or more likely to have consequences from the virus disproportionate to their white counterparts is mostly tied to chronic conditions. So the presence of high blood pressure, heart disease, liver disease, kidney disease, obesity, diabetes. These are all conditions that are more represented in our community to our number than for our white counterparts. And any sort of hit that you have to your body leading into getting infected with COVID makes you less likely to do well as a result. So since, you know, of course, if COVID affects your lung function and you have pre-existing lung disease, really severe asthma, something like that, or COPD, you're more likely to have bad outcomes. But any sort of organ that performs a major body function, if it's less fit than optimal when you become sick, then you are more likely to have a bad outcome. You know, so that's fine. But we also have to take a step back and say, all right, well, why are African-Americans and Latinx patients more likely to be obese? And you have to think about food deserts and the fact that, you know, you can be in some of these neighborhoods and it's more easy to get more processed, saltier, high calorie food than it is to get healthier food at a good price. And you may have to pass 5 or 6 bodegas, like in my neighborhood growing up, you have to pass 5 or 6 convenience stores where you could get, you know, so food before you get to a grocery store on the other side of the town. And there's not an incentive to do that. And you can't afford the prices of healthy food anyway. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about, you know, diabetes without, you know, linking that with the fact that there's less exercise space in communities of color compared to outside the suburbs and in the suburbs and where people of color don't live in high numbers. So, you know, all of these connect back to policies that were designed to favor one group over the other. You know, the fact that African-Americans and Latinx workers are more likely to work in a service sector industry and employment and job discrimination, education discrimination, all of these things kind of feed into less health and wealth in persons of color on aggregate. And that means that we're less likely to be set up for success.
Absolutely. And so in talking to some, you know, patients who recovered, they have mentioned that there are residual effects. And there's this myth kind of out there. Well, if I catch the virus, you know, it'll be fine. I'll bounce back to 100%. But a lot of people that I know personally who have had it have stated there are some residual effects, even though now that they're testing negative and that they're past the virus. So what are some residual effects that you've seen possibly in patients who've had COVID, but they have recovered from the virus, but there's still some lingering effects?
Right. So I think it's important just to put out there that it's always going to be in your best interest to not get infected with this. You don't want to try and take that risk. But what we've seen, you know, ranges from people that completely recover and go back to normal function. And that's, you know, certainly, you know, good for them. But we do see a lot of people who have some residual effects. The more common residual effects are that there's tiredness that lingers on, the headaches that we mentioned before can sometimes last a little bit longer. And then people who get critically ill or go to the intensive care unit where I work, or even if they don't make it there, but they're in the hospital for an extended period of time, may have some decrease in some of their organ function that persists and doesn't get back to the baseline. So a few people who were not on dialysis before who are on dialysis now, some people who were not on oxygen before and are on oxygen now. So, you know, these can cause some serious effects down the road, and some people's lives are going to be very different coming out of an infection with COVID-19 than when they first came in. It's not something that gets talked about a lot because we tend to just focus on you know, who lives and who dies. But there's a big conversation around what does living after this look like? And, you know, people who can't return to their work, who can't return to their normal function, who may not be being able to return home, that's a really big deal. And that's something that we have to pay attention to. And it's also going to be another drain on our healthcare resources if there are going to be a lot of people who did live. So, you know, we would put them in that column of, you know, you survived it. But they have increased healthcare needs as a result of COVID-19 that may last the rest of their life. That's going to be an ongoing strain to our healthcare system, and it's something that we need to think about when we're trying to design how do we better take care of people going forward.
Wow. So I, in looking at the news, and you know, there have been some news stories where they've done a day in the life of, mm-hmm. you know, healthcare professionals, and just a lot of things that they've had to deal with, you know, lack of PPE, or I've even saw one story where a lot of the medical staff, they were having to use trash bags to protect mm-hmm. themselves. What are some ways that the general public, and that you would like to see our government officials support our healthcare workers as you all are on the front lines of this thing?
Make people wear masks. I mean, that's and physically distance. I think the best way to support healthcare workers is to decrease the chances that people will meet us in the hospital. That is the best support that we can get right now. We appreciate, you know, the shows of love and support on social media, and the call outs and shout outs and press conferences. But I need to be able to drive home from work and go past a basketball court and see, you know, people wearing a mask if they're going to be there, or even not on the court, and practicing social distancing and physical distancing and wearing a mask. It means much more to me to see people doing the right thing than, you know, it is to, you know, have those messages of support. So I would say, you know, please send them. That's fine. We appreciate it. But tell your neighbor if they're not wearing a mask to, you know, what's behind that? You know, what are your feelings, and to do your part to try to make sure that our community keeps itself safe.
So as we close this conversation, what are some lasting things that you want the general public to know as we hopefully get on, as we work our way to try to get on the other side of cases and COVID and trying to go back to some sense of normalcy?
Yeah. So I think it's important to think about, you know, what does life look like going forward into this? Because I do think COVID is going to be with us. We were hoping, me among the many, that the heat and the humidity would kind of turn down the ability of the virus to replicate. That has clearly not been the case that we can right. see in these hot states in a hot season. So it's going to be with us. I think the vaccine is going to be the ultimate answer. But it doesn't mean that we have to completely shut down again. I don't think that's going to be the answer. I think, you know, locally there may be some areas where we have to, but the key to being able to live life and enjoy some of the things that we enjoyed doing before is really going to be on how we control the virus in the community. So if we want to have children in school, which I have a six-year-old, I definitely want him to be able to go to school and have him be safe and the teachers and staff be safe. We have to have the virus under control. That means that we need people to wear masks, we need people to practice physical distancing, trying to avoid gatherings and things like that, so that we can still enjoy the things that help the economy stay open, go to businesses, and have children in schools. I think the politicization that you mentioned has made a lot of this in opposition, so that, you know, wearing a mask really means, you know, I'm on this side or that side, or I'm on the side of public safety and you're on the side of personal freedom. It's really not about that. The mask and physical distancing and washing your hands and trying to avoid enclosed spaces, that is our tool in the toolbox that we can use in order to get to where we want to get until a vaccine comes. So the two really should be partners in trying to get us to a better spot, certainly better than where we are now. And we need to just completely disavoid, divorce the politics from this. I am happy that finally the president has tweeted a picture and even linked it with patriotism. You know, I have a lot to say about him, but I will say that, sending that message was something that we all like to see, because we want his supporters and people who follow him and use him as guidance to also follow these principles. It's not a partisan virus. It doesn't care about your political leanings, your socioeconomic status, your geography, where you come from. It just needs you to be a human being and to not be protected in order to cause infection. So that really means everyone needs to do their part in order to step up and make sure that we're safe.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah. I'm really hoping that people will get more on board. I always tell people, you know, you can't say you care about your community without going outside without putting a mask on. Like, I don't mm-hmm. even understand. Put your mask on, social distance. It may be a little uncomfortable, but it's worth it. It is so worth it. So Dr. Bell, I just want to thank you for taking time to just kind of debunk some of the myths that we've heard, kind of breaking down a little bit more about the virus and how we can protect ourselves and the people in our community.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And guys, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. I will catch you on the next one.